Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And coming up, as President Obama prepares to address the nation on immigration, we'll check in with families who have been detained because they're here without documents.
But first, as predicted, Republicans are using President Obama's own words today to bolster their argument against executive action on immigration. Soon-to-be Senate leader Mitch McConnell made a blistering speech from the Senate floor, citing Obama's words at a commencement speech in Miami 3 years ago.
And here's something else he said on that topic. I know that some wish that I could just bypass Congress and change the law myself. But that's not how democracy works. Indeed, Mr. President, it isn't.
Well, tonight, President Obama will lay out his plan to grant temporary relief to millions of undocumented immigrants in this country through executive action. Then tomorrow, he'll head to Del Sol High School in Las Vegas, Nevada. It'll be Obama's third trip to that campus in 6 years, first as a presidential hopeful in 2008. Then in 2013, he used the school as a backdrop to talk about immigration reform shortly after he was reelected. But the political climate, very different this time around. Republicans gaining control of the Senate in the midterm elections. Let's bring in NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Tamara, welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
Hi there. So go to Mitch McConnell's comments today. He also said whatever the president does, the new Congress will react forcefully in 2015. Seems that there were a couple of messages there.
Yeah, first, that he is expressing great displeasure. But second, that the new Congress will respond in 2015, not 2014. This is a hint that the leadership, that Mitch McConnell and possibly House Speaker John Boehner also, are not interested in picking this fight before they fully control Congress. If they pick this fight now, the one area of leverage that a lot of people are talking about is this big government funding bill. The funding sources for the government, that the authority expires in the middle of next month. And the leverage they would have would be to threaten a government shutdown. But they don't really want to do that. Leadership certainly doesn't. There are some rank and file who do. There are some outside groups who want to. But I think that what Mitch McConnell is signaling here is let's wait. Yeah. Let's not sock ourselves in the face.
Well, and we'll have to see if parts of that party will agree with Mitch McConnell on that. But get to the president's agenda today. Three trips to Del Sol High School in Las Vegas, the one coming today. What's the significance of Nevada for the president?
Well, and particularly also this high school. This high school has a majority Latino student body. According to the Pew Hispanic Center in Nevada, 17.7% of K-12 students, so kids in school in Nevada, have an undocumented parent or parents, which means that the kids at that school are likely to very much be affected by the executive action that the president is announcing today. Also, Nevada is a politically important state. Latinos, particularly in Nevada, have been very important both to Obama's election twice and also for the election and re-election of Harry Reid, the Senate majority leader, soon to be minority leader. And he's running again in 2016. Also, President Obama loves giving speeches at high schools and colleges with young people around him. He just loves being in gymnasiums and gets a lot of energy from that.
Well, but in the past, he's spoken to some of those young people, and they have challenged him. He's had hecklers, young people saying, "You're not moving fast enough."
Oh, absolutely, all the time. And in fact, the clip that you played with Mitch McConnell quoting the president, any number of times, the president has actually said a number of times, "I can't change the law on my own. I wish I could." Often in response to hecklers at these events. I think that the hair that the Obama administration will be splitting here is that the president isn't changing the law. He's changing the way the law is enforced. This is not granting people legal status. It's granting them temporary legal status, delaying the enforcement of the immigration law.
Can you just tell us a little more about that? What is the president expected to say? Just give us a thumbnail.
Yeah, and we don't know precisely. Mm-hmm. They're trying to save some of the drama for 8 p.m. tonight on some of your televisions. But he is unlikely to include the parents of those dreamers, that the young kids who he gave deferred action to earlier. But he is likely to expand that program for young people who were brought here by their parents. He's also likely or expected to include the parents of American citizen children. The idea here being keeping families together. Some discussion of additional visas for high-tech workers or for agricultural workers.
Yeah, so about 5 million people might be able to avoid deportation under...
That's the number going around.
Under
sure.
the president's executive action. Again, we'll hear more tonight or not. But just a little bit on that. Not all the major TV networks are carrying the president's speech.
Yeah, the cable networks obviously will, the cable news networks, NPR, tune in. But ABC, NBC, CBS, they are not interrupting their primetime television. But Telemundo and Univision are the Spanish language networks. And in some ways, that's better for the president. He'll be targeting the very audience he's trying to reach. Yeah. Obviously, the Obama administration not happy that the networks
right.
weren't willing to go along.
And by the way, Tam, John Kennedy, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush have all used executive power to reshape immigration. Just why is this? This does feel bigger, the response to that, is it?
Well, it's a very big number. But the talking point that the Obama administration will use is that on a percentage basis, this is really not that different from what George H.W. Bush did. I think that what members of Congress would say is that he's getting ahead of where they are. They would say that he should have given them more of a chance to do it on their own with a Republican majority that will start next year. And they basically are saying that he is going bigger or more broadly than past presidents did.
Yeah. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Again, President Obama's planned announcement of his planned executive action on immigration is this evening at 8:00. You can hear it here. Tam, thank you.
Thank you.
And as President Obama prepares to address the nation tonight, let's check in now on some of the undocumented immigrants who've been detained in this country at facilities like the Berks County Residential Center in Leesport, Pennsylvania. Until recently, most families passed through the facility fairly quickly. But as the government responds to the record numbers of Central American families who arrived in the U.S. this summer, immigration lawyers say their clients at the Berks Center are now being held longer than usual. Emma Jacobs reports.
Bridget Cambria is an immigration lawyer who has visited the Berks Family Residential Center many times.
You have to get permission. You call ahead. The doors are locked. When you walk in, you have to, be buzzed through.
Here's how things used to work for her clients. Cambria says families who feared being sent home had an interview with an asylum officer within a couple of weeks of arriving at the facility. If that officer found their story credible, immigration released many of them to friends or family members while their cases went through immigration court. But this summer, amid dramatic numbers of undocumented women and children arriving in the country, the Berks Center stopped releasing families. Lawyers were told the instructions came from Washington.
The worst thing is leaving a mother in a room that's locked, to go out to my car, to go about my daily life, knowing that she's stuck there with her kid, and I know that she doesn't want to be there.
While the administration has had to release tens of thousands of Central Americans to friends or family here in the U.S. for lack of space to hold them, Homeland Security is looking to expand this shelter, which holds just under 100 people, and open 3,600 beds in new facilities in border states by next year. Jessica Vaughn directs research at the Center for Immigration Studies, a think tank which advocates restricting immigration. She says detention ensures people won't be able to hide from immigration authorities once they're released.
So they're trying to, belatedly adopt a system that will allow for some semblance of rule of law.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement spokesman Harold Ort said in a statement that the goal of holding these immigrants is to deter others from Central America from making the dangerous trip through Mexico to enter the U.S. illegally. But immigrant advocates point out detention has a number of drawbacks. It's exponentially more expensive and psychologically hard on families. Just ask immigrant Laura Pena. She spent a year and a half at the Burke Center when she arrived in the U.S. 6 years ago, which was unusual at the time. She watched other families come and go.
You know, sometimes people get like crazy, you know, when they are in a lot of time in just one place.
The Pennsylvania Family Center is luxurious compared to the bare-bones shelters being built along the border. But even so, long stays can take a toll. She remembers that she used to get up when one of her favorite staff members came to work at 2 in the morning. Pena says they'd sometimes cry together about her past and her uncertain future.
I had a lot of things in my head, you know, what I'm going to do next. Or I always think this every single night. Oh, my God, if I die in here. I always, you know, saying, what my son is going to do.
The Obama administration says it's trying to streamline court proceedings for detained families. But these changes have put immigration attorneys in something of a bind.
It takes hours to develop the client's story, affidavit.
Valerie Brown, along with other lawyers, is driving out from Philadelphia to provide pro bono representation. There are no public defenders in immigration court. She doesn't want to see her clients detained for months on end, but she also needs time to prepare a case. To win asylum, Brown's clients have to gather evidence that they've suffered gang violence or abuse at home. She says it's much more difficult to do that while you're in detention.
Not only the time to prepare it, but the time for the person to be able to feel comfortable enough to provide, you know, all of the terrible details of what they've been through in their home country.
The answer, she argues, is to go back to the way things were before the summer, when families were let go and allowed to prepare their case from the world outside these walls. For Here and Now, I'm Emma Jacobs in Philadelphia.
And before we go to break, an update on a story we brought you earlier this month. Plans for the first townwide ban on tobacco sales in the country have been snuffed out. The Board of Health in Westminster, Massachusetts, last night voted down a proposal to ban the sale of all tobacco products. A board member saying, "It's obvious the town is against it, and therefore I am against it." And we're now just a week away from Thanksgiving, so if you're planning on hosting a dinner, maybe it's time to buy a bird. And there are plenty of choices: frozen, fresh, organic, antibiotic-free. Let's focus on that last one for a moment. Right now, only about 5% of meat sold in the U.S. is antibiotic-free, but more companies are jumping on the bandwagon. Last year, Tyson Foods, the largest poultry company in the U.S., launched a line of antibiotic-free chicken and beef. Purdue has done the same. Some smaller companies have been selling antibiotic-free meat for much longer. D'Artagnan has been in the business for almost 30 years. Ariane Daguin is the company's founder and CEO. She's with us from New York. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, why did you get into this business so long ago, before it was in fashion to be selling antibiotic-free meat?
Yes, and I hope this is not a fashion. I hope it's here to stay. But I come from a long line of chefs in France, in Southwest France. And my father always taught me that in order to be a good chef, in order to do good food, you have to use the best ingredient possible. And I always loved anything that has to do with animal proteins, whether it's meat or poultry. And at D'Artagnan, when we started 29 years ago, we started with a good food, which is, you know, to find, to source, and to organize farmers to get the best ingredient possible, whether it's a poultry or meat.
Well, and why did you have such a problem with antibiotics? Because as we know, the vast majority of meat that is sold in this country is using animal product, that these animals were raised with antibiotics.
For me, there are two problems. For my company, D'Artagnan, again, because of the mission, the problem number one is that when you load a herd or a coop full of poultry with antibiotic medication, it's in order to crowd it and to grow faster. So it's to make a better yield and not as good a bird, because they're going to be crowded in there. They're not going to exercise their muscle. It's basically factory farming. the second problem, which is really bad for the population, is that by eating an animal that has been eating regularly antibiotics, you run the risk of building antibiotic-resistant bacteria in your body. So the day you're sick and you want to therapeutically be cured with antibiotic, it might not work anymore because those bacteria in your body are used to it already.
But it can be a lot more expensive for consumers to buy meat that is antibiotic-free. How difficult has it been for you over the years to convince people to pay the extra money to get the antibiotic-free meat?
It's all about education. Once you taste the superiority of birds that or animals that have been well-raised, once you taste it, you never come back. And so at the beginning, the only way to taste it was in restaurants because we, at D'Artagnan, we were talking to chefs. Chefs are educated already. They understand the difference, especially on the taste side. And so they always were willing to pay more and to use the good ingredients. And now, little by little, the consumer understands that, and there are priorities in life. Eh? You either you buy your very expensive sneakers or you decide to buy your animal protein and your proteins in a better quality, you know? And so, little by little, this is switching with the advent of the foodies and all those TV shows that show the respect of the ingredients of all the chefs. People, little by little, decide to put more money into what they put in their mouth, which is very important. You are what you eat. So if you eat crap, something is going to happen to your body eventually.
Have you been hurt by the fact that so many food producers have started to put labels on their products that don't mean anything? So you might say, we're organic, we're antibiotic-free. Somebody else might say, we're all natural, or we're raising these hens cage-free. There are certain labels that mean more than others, as you know.
Yeah, it's a constant battle. We're going in the right direction, but it's a constant battle. If a label says humanly raised, for example, you should make sure that there is a certification there by a third party, an independent third party. If it says all natural, today it doesn't mean anything anymore. It has to say antibiotic-free. The next step, the one that I'm fighting right now, is to say antibiotic-free never ever. Never ever meaning you never gave any antibiotics to that animal. Because right now, there is big pressure for the USDA to put on the label, to accept on the label antibiotic-free, even though the animal has had antibiotics and is on something called a withdrawal program. You know, it's okay if the animal hasn't had any for a certain length of time before processing to say antibiotic-free. Well, that's not cool. When you say antibiotic-free, that means from birth.
What do you think the percentage of the meat that we buy in this country that is antibiotic-free will be 20 years from now? Because as we know, at this point, it's a pretty small percentage.
If it were up to me, 100%. Antibiotics are medication. Its purpose is to cure ailments, to cure an animal that has been sick. It is not to promote growth. It is not to enhance and promote chemically, artificially, factory farming. So if it were up to me, it would not be allowed except, again, you know, to help an animal that needs it because it's sick. And I think, again, we're growing in the right direction.
Finally, I have to ask you how you're going to be preparing your own turkey.
What I do is the night before, I bought a very big pot and I poach my big bird in a bouillon, you know, a broth, a mm-hmm. very rich broth. And I do that only half an hour to 45 minutes. So the bird is not really cooked at that point. I let it cool in the bouillon. So that broth is going to be a magnificent soup, you know, to a base and to put butternut squash or chestnut to make a first course the next day. But most importantly, that bird, when it comes out of there once cool the next day, is very, very moist inside. It's like brining and simmering, poaching in the same time. And so when you put it in the oven at a very high heat, don't hesitate to go up to 400, 450. Then you crisp the skin on the outside. And no matter what, even if you leave it there too long, even if you overcook your turkey, everything is going to be super moist inside. It's a foolproof recipe.
I'm sure we'll have some listeners that are going to try it. Ariane Daguin, the owner and CEO of D'Artagnan, a supplier of organic and antibiotic-free meats in the U.S. Thanks so much for joining us and happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You too. Thank you very much, Jeremy.
And of course, Robin, some listeners may go even further and just go with a tofurkey.
That's right, tofu.
But what do you think? Are you willing to pay the extra money to buy antibiotic-free or organic poultry? And if so, is it because of health reasons or is it for taste? Let us know at our website, hereandnow.org or facebook.com/hereandnowradio.
And another reason could be for the animal. When you see that
Absolutely.
Turkey stuffed, unable to even stand
As
up.
As she was saying right there, they're putting way too many of them in one small place. And this antibiotic situation allows them to do that. You're listening to Here and Now.
It was thought that Marilyn Robinson was the front runner for the National Book Award for Fiction this year with Lila, her exquisite look at a homeless girl in Iowa. But the book that won was also exquisitely written, as well as hilarious, biting, whipsawing, sad. Some of the words reviewers used to describe former Marine Phil Clay's short story collection about the war in Iraq, Redeployment. Clay served in Anbar Province in 2007 and 8. He writes about troops at war, a contractor who hilariously thinks teaching Iraqi kids baseball will solve everything. But also he writes about a vet who comes home and can't go to a shopping mall. Phil Clay joins a talented group of veterans writing about their experience, and he joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
What were you trying to say?
I was trying to invite readers in to imagine these experiences from the inside of the heads of different people at different times in Iraq, because it's so intense, not just what you experience when you deploy, but also coming back home, what America looks like after you've been at war and what you make of it. And I think it's a really important conversation to be having.
Well, in your acceptance speech last night, you said you came back from Iraq not knowing what to think when children asked you if you'd killed anyone. Was this a way of trying to figure out answers to those questions?
Yeah, middle school students, they were very disappointed when I told them no. And then we had a conversation about, you know, what that question actually means. I've had veteran friends tell me that, you know, did you kill anyone is the most obscene question you can ask a veteran.
Mm. Well, and of course, in the case of kids, that's the way of turning it into an action movie, you know, which it's
right.
Not,
and
right?
And what was actually kind of great about that was they were super excited, but then we actually had a really good talk about what that meant. Even though they were kids, they got it pretty quickly. I think there are all these stories that we have about war that help us try and imagine it or help us avoid imagining what it actually is. And, you know, with my book, I wanted to add some different stories to the conversation that would hopefully, you know, challenge some of the narratives out there that I think are unhelpful.
Yeah. Just pick a couple of moments that you got across, either the dark gallows humor or the pain or what. Just a couple moments that you're pleased with.
So one of the things that I did, I have, for example, a scene where there are artillerymen and they've just had their first mission where they've actually shot at living targets, right? Except the target is very far away from them. And they're discussing, you know, did they kill anybody? And if so, how much responsibility do they individually have for the people they killed? And they're sort of excited about it. I have that story and their disconnect from the actual violence that's being committed. And then, you know, in another story, I have a mortuary affairs specialist, or the Marines who prepare the bodies of the dead to be sent home. And he doesn't do any killing, but he's in a very physically immediate way interacting with the bodies of the dead. Those are two stories. I always wanted stories that would kind of look at similar topics from very different angles.
Yeah. Well, the judges certainly felt they did. Again, Phil Clay's collection of short stories, fictionalized account of the time he spent in Iraq, is called Redeployment. Just want to mention, you were part of a special New York Times project called Home Fires. It featured the writing of
yes,
vets of Iraq and Afghanistan. How much did that help being part of what seems like a particularly talented community of writers?
Tremendous. The body of literature from veterans of the recent wars is continuing to grow, and it's something that I'm very excited about, and I think it's something that's very good and healthy.
Phil Clay, again, his book is Redeployment, National Book Award winner for this year. Thanks so much, and congratulations again.
Thank you.
The book is being compared to Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried About the Vietnam War. High praise. We highly recommend it. Thunder snow is now hitting the Buffalo area. Thunder, lightning, and snow on top of the 6 feet of snow already on the ground. Roofs have collapsed. People are literally snowed into their homes. And, of course, at least 8 have died. Today, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo talked about clearing the snow out.
This is, I believe, the largest deployment of its kind ever. Literally thousands of people from across the state coming in to help and hundreds of pieces of equipment.
And they better move fast. It's going to be warm this weekend, and that will mean flooding. Brian Meyer is news director at WBFO in Buffalo. And Brian, snow's too heavy for plows. We're seeing pictures of front loaders scooping it up into trucks. How's the clear going?
Well, I'm telling you, some of even the most weather-tested Western New Yorkers are snowed out. We're used to storms.
Right.
We're used to even blizzards, but
right.
This is something that is quite exceptional. I mean, we've got 5 feet, sometimes in some cases 6 feet of snow already on the ground, now in sort of giant mounds around curbs and so forth. And we've got some areas hardest hit that may be getting up to 2 feet more.
I saw a picture of a car driving down a cleared road. And the snowpack on top of the car had to be 6 feet high. And obviously, you couldn't get it off. And I thought, when that thing goes, it's going to...
Well, guess what?
What?
I was driving to a 6 a.m. briefing this morning, and the truck in front of me had exactly that. And I was very fortunate that it came off in the other direction.
Right, right. So dangerous. Well, so maybe 60 degrees on Monday, that's got to mean flooding.
Well, absolutely. You may look at the equivalent of, say, 7 inches of rain. Imagine that. And the state has already committed some special equipment, including some pumps. This is according to county officials. But there's going to be some major flooding issues. You know, it may rival some of the challenges that we're facing with the snow version of this precipitation.
Right. Well, you know, with all these serious issues, I hate to ask what might seem like a trivial question, but we've seen so many people snowed in. 6 feet covers their whole door, and they open the door, and we've seen the funny pictures about how they're making that snow into a refrigerator. But how do you dig that out? Do you dig the snow into the house? How do you?
Well, you know, we've heard of some people that are actually hiring their own contractors to try to dig them out. Others have actually had to spend hours digging out just little narrow paths for their little canine friends. I mean, what do these dogs think? You know, so I mean, they've had to spend time, you know, digging out just small paths for their pets. So it is really it's really unprecedented. Yeah. You know, some of our officials here have called it an epic storm. And I don't think they're overestimating the case, at least in those hardest hit areas.
Well, be so careful when you make those little tunnels and things to get out. Those things collapse, walls collapse.
Yes.
So take care. Brian Meyer, news director there at WBFO in Buffalo, New York. Beautiful town, but you can barely see it right now. Brian, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, switching gears now to Obamacare 2.0, which is now underway with a new round of open enrollments. Colorado is one state that saw a decline in the number of uninsured people after the Affordable Care Act went into effect. And now the push is on in Colorado to sign up even more people. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Colorado Public Radio's John Daly reports.
Lee Trujillo wears a lot of hats here in Leadville. He co-owns and runs a tavern on the town's main street. He's also a certified health insurance navigator.
Some states were called navigators, and that's pretty much what we do, is we just help navigate folks through this whole new world of insurance.
He does this, helps people find their way through Colorado's healthcare exchange, sometimes from his bar.
Hi there. Welcome. Hi, Helen.
Hi.
Hi, William.
How are you doing, Senor?
Senor, I'm doing fine.
Why Helen and William Gallegos have dropped in. They need Trujillo's help to figure out a health insurance plan.
But how many hours did you work on average last month each week?
I would say maybe 25.
25.
See?
You did increase that.
Trujillo asks questions as he scrolls through Colorado's Exchange website. He finds out that Helen has been working part-time as a janitor. Last year, she got insurance for the first time in her life through Medicaid. Now she doesn't qualify because she's had a slight increase in her household income. It's a little less than $21,000 a year. Her husband, William, says they're looking for a plan on the private market.
I know she's going to need it down the road. She's going to need some kind of insurance, you know. And I know she's healthy as a horse, and I just wanted some insurance for her because we never know. I mean, you get sick.
Trujillo hears this a lot, but buying health insurance isn't like, say, shopping for new tires for your car. There are all sorts of variables to consider. premiums, out-of-pocket costs, deductibles, tax credits. In short, Trujillo says it's complicated. Despite that, he's signed up hundreds of his neighbors for insurance. He sets up shop at partner agencies, clinics, and here at his bar.
Because it's such a small town, they kind of know my routine, and they will either catch me on the way to the post office or Safeway, or it's just one of those wonderful towns where we just wear multiple hats and just help each other out.
According to one estimate, Lake County's uninsured rate dropped from 23% to 12% since the Affordable Care Act went into effect this year. Statewide, Colorado has signed up more than 425,000 people who were uninsured before. Colorado ranks in the top five states, seeing the biggest decline in the number of people who are uninsured.
Hands clapping. Let's give it up for that team.
Hundreds of health professionals last month held a pep rally of sorts at a conference in Denver. Sue Birch, who directs Colorado's Medicaid agency, says one goal is to sign up those still uninsured, many of them 20-somethings and Latinos. She aims to bring the uninsured rate under 10%.
We think that we can find the bulk of those folks this next go-around.
This next go-around, the exchange has a revamped website with new tools. Instead of two applications to fill out, there's now just one form to determine if someone qualifies for Medicaid or tax credits for private insurance. Michelle Leake with the nonpartisan, nonprofit Colorado Health Institute sees year two of the Affordable Care Act as a work in progress.
You're going to move from issues of access to health care to issues of utilization. Is there a workforce there to take care of all Coloradans who now have health insurance? Is it adequate? Is it quality?
There are other big questions to answer. Will Colorado's exchange be self-sustaining financially by next year, as required by state law? And for William Gallegos, he questions how affordable federally mandated health insurance will be. He says now that his wife Helen has insurance, they want to keep it.
As long as the premiums doesn't keep going up, I mean, you know.
The couple's navigator, Lee Trujillo, finds Helen a plan she can afford.
I think I like that plan.
You think you like that plan? It's going to be $58 a month. Is that something you want me to just get you enrolled with?
Helen Gallego says it works for her. This mid-level plan will have her paying with tax credits and cost sharing, at most $500 out of pocket. Trujillo says he's confident the state will bring its uninsured rate lower by signing up consumers like Helen one at a time. For Here and Now, I'm John Daly.
Hunger Games fans, you know that sound. The new film Mockingjay Part 1 opens in theaters tonight. It is the third in the series based on Suzanne Collins' best-selling books. They're set in a dystopian future where an oppressive capital rules over 12 increasingly rebellious districts. Children are forced to compete in the battle-to-the-death Hunger Games. Jennifer Lawrence returns as Katniss Everdeen, also known as the Mockingjay. She's been rescued from her second Hunger Games by District 13, which is leading the rebellion. Her fellow competitor, PETA, played by Josh Hutcherson, was left behind and is now being used by the Capitol for propaganda purposes.
PETA, a lot of people feel as though they are in the dark.
Yeah, I know how they feel.
Now, so set the stage for us. Talk us through what really happened on that final and controversial night.
Well, first off, you have to understand that when you're in the games, you only get one wish. It's very costly.
The rebels, meanwhile, want to use Katniss as a propaganda tool. Francis Lawrence directed the film, and he joins us from KUT in Austin. Welcome.
Thank you.
So the one thing I took away after watching this is no matter what the reviews end up saying, this film is going to make a fortune because everybody in America is going to go see this with their family on Thanksgiving. Why do you think that the nation has been so captivated, not just by this Hunger Games movie, but by the whole story?
Well, I think, you know, I think it goes all the way back to the source material that Suzanne Collins created. You know, she had this idea to write a series of books for teenagers about the consequence of war. And I think every decision that she made was based on that idea. And then she's created a really compelling story, great characters, especially the character of Katniss, which I think is going to sort of go down as one of the great characters of all time. And then you kind of have the magic of this cast, you know, populating those characters.
What was the hardest part about bringing this to the big screen, though? Because there are a lot of things that you have to do that we can just imagine in the book. But when you bring it to the big screen, you've got to create the image on screen and sometimes very complicated images.
Yeah, there's some complicated things in this movie. I think the trick with this is that the first half of this book, you know, we've split the book into two movies. And the first half of this book is very internal. And a lot of this movie deals with a propaganda war. And so in the book, Katniss is thinking about things and hearing about things a lot, and we're not seeing very much of it, which can be fine for a reading experience. But for a movie experience, we needed to figure out how to make that visual. And so the adaptation of that sort of internal dialogue that Katniss is having with herself and turning that into a visual experience was pretty tricky.
It's freeing in a way, though, too, because you get to see things in the film that you would never know were going on in the book. I'm thinking specifically of some of the rebellion in the districts and the blowing up of a dam, if I'm not giving too much away.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's really fun for us. You know, we sort of call it world expansion. It's all things that could have been happening in the book. We just didn't get a chance to see. And that's the part of what we got to do.
What do you think were the negatives of doing it as a movie rather than a book? I'm sure there are going to be a lot of people who come away saying, I liked the book better, as they always do with movies.
Well, they don't always come on.
Most of the time.
Look, I love the book. I think we made this for the fans. I also think that the fans know that you can't sort of exactly turn the book into a movie, especially when it's so internal. So I'm sure there's going to be little, you know, sort of moments and pieces of dialogue that Katniss thought to herself that will never be able to make the movie, that they'll be disappointed about. But I think they're going to be really excited by the things that we did put in and the new additions. And, you know, some of that expansion actually allows us to surprise even the strictest fans.
Why did you split it into two?
Quite honestly, to get more book in the movies. You know, it's always challenging when you take a 400-plus page book and you try and distill it down to a two-hour movie. There's a lot of loss. But, you know, one of the reasons that we did this was that there really are two distinct stories in this, the front end being the kind of propaganda war and where Katniss really starts to take on the responsibility as a symbol for the rebellion, and she starts to fight back. The second one, you know, really is a war story and much more about revenge and vengeance. And so they're completely different character arcs for Katniss. So it made it much easier to split.
Well, let's talk about what Katniss is doing in this film, which is largely making propaganda films for District 13. At first, it seems like Katniss doesn't want to take part in this. She later agrees. And here in this scene, Katniss meets the television crew that's going to follow her every move. Let's listen.
You're all from the Capitol? Plutarch got you out?
Don't expect much chit-chat from him. Capitol cut his tongue out years ago. And no, it wasn't any sort of rescue, if that's what you mean. We all fled on our own. For this. For you.
You know, as I was watching this and seeing how important propaganda was, I couldn't help but think of the news that's going on right now and ISIS even making these propaganda films that they are of beheadings and other things.
It's pretty chilling when you see some of the ways that some of the ideas and imagery in this movie is sort of mirrored in what we see on the news today. And I was just recently talking to Suzanne Collins about it, you know, and she said, you know, unfortunately, it mirrors things that have been happening, you know, for hundreds, if not thousands of years.
One of the people we heard in that clip there was Natalie Dormer, who people may know from Game of Thrones. There's also Mahershala Ali is in this movie, who people may know from House of Cards. Did their success in those shows increase their chances of being cast in these roles? Did that have anything to do with it?
No, it was purely their acting ability. I mean, Natalie and I had been trying to work together for a while. Actually, met with her about a TV show years ago. I've been a fan of hers for a long time. A bunch of us were a fan of Mahershala from the show. But really, it wasn't the popularity of the show. It was really just how perfect they were for the characters.
And, of course, there is the late Philip Seymour Hoffman. And there were a lot of questions about what exactly was going to happen with his role. Can you tell us a little bit about what you had to do after he passed away to make this movie? Because he is all over this movie.
Yeah, he is a big part of it. You know, on Catching Fire, he shot for about 3 weeks. And I think over the 3 weeks, he worked for about 10 days. In these movies, we shot part one and part two back to back. He was scheduled for, I want to say, 55 days. I mean, he had a lot more work. He was almost finished with his work on the movies when he died. And he had two substantial scenes left, one for each movie. There was no way we were ever going to try and, you know, duplicate him digitally somehow and craft some kind of a performance. I mean, he, you know, was one of the best, you know, actors alive. and there's no way we're going to try and, you know, make up a performance from him. So we rewrote the scenes and gave his parts to other actors. But, you know, I think quite honestly, the toughest thing for everybody was just dealing with it emotionally, getting back to work, trying to find a groove again after he died.
This is a Hunger Games movie that does not include a Hunger Games. Do you think people are going to be disappointed by that?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, quite honestly, it was, you know, it was sort of a relief for me that I, you know, could tell a story that sort of moves forward and the stakes kind of ratchet up and it becomes a little more global within the Hunger Games world, rather than sort of following the same kind of narrative structure again and, you know, going back through the Capitol and training and another set of games. I think it would start to feel pretty repetitive by now.
Was there a one-minute period in the film that just took so much more energy and effort than any other part of the film? And can you tell us what it was?
I'd say that the dam, the rebel attack on the dam, I think was a really, really tricky one. You know, you've got loads and loads of extras. You're dealing with a lot of, you know, fake firing, a lot of squib hits, so that everybody that's getting hit with squibs has to get wired with these little dust packs in their costumes. And so, you know, you've got 300 people charging, all getting shot, squibs firing, and then, okay, you got one take, now you have to rewire all of them again. You know, plus we've got the water spraying and, you know, lots of effects happening there. So that was a pretty tricky sequence.
Francis Lawrence is the director of Mockingjay Part 1. It opens in theaters tonight. Francis Lawrence, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
It's fake blood. It's fake blood. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.